Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to yet another of our CPD evenings. 90 minutes of live CPD, which counts towards your learning with others if you are a UK osteopath or chiropractor. And as always, it's just damn good CPD if you're any other profession. This evening's CPD, we have got orthopaedic consultant Nick Birch from the Chris Moody Centre at Northampton at Malton College coming to talk to us about spinal surgery. Nick has been a consultant for some 20 years now, and throughout that time he's been lecturing both nationally and internationally, and he's now based at the Chris Moody Centre, which is, I think, one of a kind in terms of rehabilitation for people suffering back pain and surgery. Nick, welcome to the studio. It's a great pleasure to have you here. And I should mention to all our watchers that you run a fantastic CPD group, which incorporates physiotherapists, osteopaths, sports therapists, Pilates teachers, hydrotherapy practitioners. I mean, the whole gamut of rehabilitation that goes on, as one would expect, at the Chris Moody Centre. But we'll come back to that, I'm sure. I know your ambition, of course, has been to cure back pain, as you told me a few minutes ago. But the burning question in everybody's mind, bearing in mind the news today, is what music do you listen to when you're operating?
Well, until I stopped operating last year, I went through phases, death metal, symphonic metal, all of those things. Mm. I got to the stage where I just wanted a melody. So people like Tina Dico and Sarah McLachlan, they were sort of my top favourites. So it was a wide range.
So how good was the death metal for communication within the team in the operating theatre?
It was great, as long as it wasn't too loud, that's fine. Mm. So in spinal surgery, you're pretty sort of delving into the patient and everything's very close. And so we can communicate even if by hand signal.
Yeah. So the research today, the news today about music in the operating theatre distracting people, presumably it's specific types of surgery which are most effective.
I think, and individuals as well. So if you've got someone who's really bothered by external influences, or if you're doing an operation where communication, verbal communication really is important, having music is not going to be helpful. Quite a lot of spinal surgery is, you know, it's heads over the patient, you're doing stuff, you don't need to worry about what's going on elsewhere. So having music in the background is actually quite nice. Yeah.
Now, I mentioned your background. You've had 20 years as a consultant. All of that on spinal surgery?
Yes, I was appointed as an orthopaedic consultant in 1996, so that's 19 years now, at Northampton General Hospital. And within a very short period of time, I specialised in spine. I'd done a spinal fellowship at the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital and at the Royal Free in London. So quite quickly, I got rid of the other bits of orthopaedics that I wasn't particularly interested in and set up the spinal unit at Northampton. So we ran that until 2002 when I left Northampton General and then moved into private practice.
We've talked to a number of consultants on these broadcasts, and it seems that there are relatively few people these days whose scope of practice is terribly broad. Most people seem to be focusing on distinct areas. When you say you do spinal surgery, how far up the spine do you go?
Lumbar, thoracolumbar, and then down to the sacrum. So I'm not a whole spine surgeon. So the guys who do that tend to be in the big specialist units, Birmingham, London, etc. And they do front and back, top to bottom. So I would do anywhere from here down to there, front and back, which is fine. But I never got interested in doing stuff at the neck.
Right, okay. And is that still the case, that people will do whole spine surgery, bearing in mind this drive towards...
Yeah, in general terms. I mean, quite often you get people who... Nowadays, because training changed about 15 years ago, so there was a real drive to get specialists into district general hospital-type setups, so they'd be competent to do the neck as well as the lumbar spine. The chest is a bit different because you need slightly different facilities in the hospital. So you need a high dependency or intensive care because you have a chest drain in if you open the chest up and that sort of stuff. So by and large, most people do anterior cervical surgery, posterior screws and rods, same with the lumbar spine, and then leave the middle to the specialist units.
Right, okay. So in terms of the surgery that where you specialised, what's your typical patient who comes to you and how do they get to you?
95% of people come to me with backache. And of those, then a very, very small portion are going to, I say backache, there's obviously neck pain as well, but a very small portion are going to be ending up needing surgery. The vast majority are people who have got ordinary degenerative conditions in the lumbar spine that need to have, one, an explanation of what they've got, two, education as to how they can make themselves better and self-manage, three, a direction steer as to what's their rehabilitation. So that could be osteopathy, it could be physiotherapy, it could be chiropractic. At the end of the day, what's common to them all is that they need to have an understanding of the biopsychosocial model of back pain so that all the various components of the back pain can be treated. So if you as an osteopath saw somebody and merely said, I'm just going to manipulate you and that's it, chum, out you go, that person isn't going to get better. You know, they become therapy dependent because they'll get better for a bit and they'll come back because they haven't got any tool to self-manage. So for me, the key is the education of the patient. You know, they've got to understand what their condition is and then be able to be able to manage that as best as possible. And then when they come back to a therapist, then they're going to hopefully be able to do that for a short period of time, and that's the intervention they need. If they need surgery, that's because they've got a problem with nerve pain, neurological conditions, a gross instability, spondylolisthesis is a good example. These are people who've tried to manage for a long period of time, and not just the sort of what the Americans call conservative treatment. Well, we did 3 months of conservative therapy and then we operated on them. That's just ridiculous. Because if you've got a long-term problem, doing 3 months of exercise isn't going to get it better. So, you know, they've done 6 months, 9 months, a year. They really try very hard. They've put the effort in with their exercises and all the core stuff has been done. They've had all the manipulation, all the massage that you can imagine, and still they're not getting better. They're the ones who then start to go down the path to heading towards surgery, but many of them don't get there. Many of them were just injection treatments and often a bit of CBT, something just to sort of allow them to manage better, to cope better. They'll avoid surgery. And at the end of the day, maybe 2 or 3% of people presenting with back pain will come to an operation. Now, that's not radicular pain, and that's quite separate. And what's interesting is that if you go back to 2009, when NICE published their guidance, the guidance was about back pain. It wasn't about back pain separated from leg pain and neurological symptoms. At the moment, we're just in the process of launching the Pathfinder project. So that's been done. That was done by NHS England. And Pathfinder had 30 different stakeholder groups in it, of which osteopathy, physiotherapy and chiropractic and spinal surgery are all part of it. And what Pathfinder's done is separated out into back pain and radicular pain. So if you then present with leg pain, you go down a different pathway. It's really fast-tracked. And the idea with that is that you're going to get people who've got sciatic pain, plus or minus neurology, maybe some red flags for quadra equina, etc. They're going to be put through a fast track, sorted out, and then the majority of them will get better without an intervention, or maybe just an injection. They don't need all surgery, but they get fast back. The back pain side of it is much better managed now through the Pathfinder because it brings in that psychosocial component to it, and it brings in functional restoration very early. So that's a combined physical psychological therapy program, and that might be an outpatient program. It could be a specialist inpatient program. It depends on the patient. What that really has done, or will do when it's been launched, is to make sense of back pain, radicular pain. And the key person in that pathway is going to be what's called the triage and treat practitioner. And the nice thing about that is that you don't have to be a specialist in any particular area to be that. It's a competency-based thing. So there'll be osteopaths, there'll be chiropractors, there'll be nurses, there'll be physios who'll do that role, and they will guide patients' journeys. And at the end of it, the very bottom, when you've gone through the whole thing, there's a final decision. Do you need an operation, yes or no? And as I say, maybe a few percent of people going through that process will need that. So that's really sort of the modern management of back pain in the UK, or at least in England, that's coming up. And hopefully it's going to make some sense.
They're doing something along those lines, are they not, at Nottingham, the Queen's Medical Centre there? One of our colleagues, an osteopath, works within their team, and they've got a very neatly diagrammed triage process to get people through to either surgery or manual therapy.
Yeah.
So is that everywhere in the country now?
No, it's bitty, and that's the trouble. The reason there are two big bits of work. One was the strategic review of spinal services that was set up by NHS England in about 2011, and that was because the perception of the very uneven provision of spinal services in England. So the Spinal Services Review came up with a plan to produce a network, and the network is what was Nottingham is functioning with. And this is a hub and spoke model. So you have in the middle a hub whereby you have all the specialist services, and then outside that there are spoke hospitals or spoke units, some which are specialist and will be doing some specialist work, and then others are complete non-specialists. So here in Northampton, for instance, there's no spinal presence. There was a spinal surgeon, but he moved to Leicester. So there's no spinal presence anymore. So if you have a spinal problem in Northampton, that's a non-specialist spoke hospital. If you need something doing, you'll be transferred to the local hub, which is Leicester or Nottingham, wherever it is. Nottingham are ahead of the game. They have been for a long time. I mean, they were the leaders in spinal care going back into the late 1980s and early 1990s when John Webb was running the unit and Heather Prince. That's been taken over by leading lights now, Bronik Boschek and Nas Qureshi, Mike Gravett, people like that. So they've always been ahead of the game, but that's an exemplar. And it would be very nice if the whole of the country could function like that. So that people could find their way through the system very quickly and easily and effectively.
Yeah. Well, talking of exemplars, you've said that the Chris Moody Centre at Moulton College is one of a kind, it's unique.
Yeah.
What are the facilities there? What makes it so good?
I think it's the multidisciplinary input there. I mean, if you walk into the front door of the Chris Moody, to the right you've got two hydrotherapy pools. One's a hydrotherapy gym. So it's an underwater cycle, underwater treadmill. The other's a standard hydrotherapy pool. So there aren't that many places around with two hydrotherapy pools available for 18 hours a day. And then upstairs you have eight therapy rooms for osteopaths, chiropractors, dietitians, psychologists, me, lots of physiotherapists. Move through that, you get into a rehab area where we do neurological rehabilitation, Pilates. Mm-hmm. They've got Karen Grinter has her Pilates studio there with four reformers in it. They do the group classes in the rehab area. Go a little bit beyond that, you get to physio function, which is the neurological physio. So we now have, it's the reference center for the Rex Bionics powered assisted device to allow paralyzed people to walk, and all of the functional electrical stimulation stuff that John Graham does there. Go beyond that, and you get to the cryotherapy chamber. So we have the people like the Saints and the Cobblers, the professional teams locally. They will come in after games on a Saturday or a Sunday. They'll go and do their cryotherapy. So it's 3 minutes of minus 140 degrees. That's instead of the ice baths. Go beyond that, and you get downstairs into the 25-meter swimming pool, which has got a raisable floor. So you can put toddlers in at 18 inches or go down 6'6" for full-blown Olympics. Go to the back of the room, to the building, and we've got all of the teaching facilities from Moulton College for all their biomedical teaching. So it is unique. It's a phenomenal place, and it's got lots and lots of stuff in it. And for rehabilitation, you can pretty much do everything.
So who's using it? Are NHS patients getting access to this, or are these purely private patients?
At the moment, it's purely private patients. And at the end of the day, it comes down to what the commissioners will buy. And the commissioners may either not know it exists or don't want to purchase services from it. We had a meeting with one of our local GPs who's been on the commissioning board for a long time to sound them out. It was really quite sort of depressing in many respects because, you talk to a guy who's been in practice for 15 years. He was my SHO when I was at Stanmore doing spinal fellowship. And back in those days, he was a very cheerful, bubbly junior doctor, and he's been ground down by the process of the NHS and the bureaucracy, and he just can't see a way round the funding crisis that is the NHS right now, and the idea that somehow we could provide decent rehabilitation that could then be available for NHS patients didn't seem to be able to sort of bridge that gap. To sort of say, okay, there's an unmet need. How do we actually get there? He just couldn't see them.
Which, as you say, is very sad. I've been approached recently by practitioners asking how they can get a contract with the NHS the way we in my clinic have got one in this county, as have many other people. We've got the osteopathy contract. That, of course, is in question for the obvious reason that funds are limited. Yeah. And when you talk about the biopsychosocial model, actually, even that NHS contract doesn't allow us to apply the biopsychosocial model because we can provide CBT in our clinic and we can provide acupuncture and all sorts of rehab, but we are very limited in what we're allowed to provide. And I know that some of the physiotherapy contracts are even more limited in what practitioners can do.
Well, the physiotherapy contracts are in many respects sort of they've come out of the private practice model, and that is the network. So the big private medical insurers have decided that what they want to have is a generic package of physiotherapy to get rid of the consultant, because consultants are expensive. So the idea being that a patient will ring up, if they've got insurance with Viva or Bupa or AXA PPP, they'll ring up and say, my back hurts. And they'll say, fine. And they'll go through a case management or triage system, and then they'll be diverted to a network physiotherapist. And they will have four sessions of physiotherapy, irrespective of the diagnosis, irrespective of the psychosocial component of it. It is supposed to be that the CBT element actually comes into that, but it doesn't, and that's the reality of it. And then, depends upon who the physiotherapist is, they might say, you know, patient pitches up with rip-roaring leg pain, and you know, that hasn't been picked up on the triage service, and it's a quick call back to the case management team saying, I can't treat this patient, they need to be sent to someone who can do that and get a scan and sort them out. Yeah. And then I get a call saying, oh, well, they've had one session of physiotherapy with a network physio, and you know they need to be sorted out. So that was the private medical insurer model that has been effectively taken up by the NHS. I don't know which one started it, but at the end of the NHS, one, you wait horrendous amounts of time for physiotherapy.
29 weeks, I heard from somebody here recently.
It is nonsense. It's totally nonsense. Yeah, you might as well just say, we're going to make you all chronic.
You know, well, interesting, when we went to our meeting, for the commissioning meeting for the contract we've got now, they were talking about acute and chronic patients.
Yeah.
Then they talked about the waiting list, and nobody seemed to have worked out that there were no acute patients, because nobody got there that quickly.
No, because the NICE guidance in 2009 didn't even consider acute patients, because it said that we could talk about back pain from 6 weeks to 1 year. So it ignored acute back pain, but we know that an acute intervention can prevent chronicity. Yeah. So if you actually get somebody, and it doesn't matter whether it's you or the physiotherapist down the road or the chiropractor or somebody who's actually sort of putting some time and effort in to treat these patients, because most of it, as you say, is the biopsychosocial side of things, it's education, getting them to understand what's going on. You know, you go through the triage, make sure they've not got red flags. If they've not got red flags, is it a non-structural lumbar spine problem? Yeah, okay, that's fine. So they're going to get some decent treatment and some education and some understanding and time with a therapist, which is really important. Mm. And when they got that, it may well be that they have 2, 3, 4 sessions, end of the acute episode, and they don't go into chronicity.
Yeah.
But if you say to them, okay, go see your GP, have some physiotherapy, and by the way, the waiting time is 29 weeks. By the time they get to see the physiotherapist, the GP signed them off for 5 sessions of 6 weeks each time. They've not been at work that time. They've gone chronic. That's it.
Yes.
There's nothing you can do about that. Mm. Well, there is. Now you can apply to them a £5,000 rehabilitation program, what's called a functional restoration program or a combined physical psychological program. But it's going to cost £5,000 because it's an inpatient program, takes 2 weeks, because to unpick that chronicity, that's the only way you can do that.
Yeah.
So, and there's some good evidence. There was a paper in rehabilitation research last year from the Dallas group showing that if you got people early, it's very cost effective. If you do your rehabilitation early, it's cost effective. It reduces medical input. The actual cost of the rehabilitation is much less. If you do it late, it works, but it's very expensive. So.
I also have some personal research as a case study, which it suggests to me that the policy at the moment is slightly flawed, because the standard policy for back pain, unless you've got a certain level of score on the start back scoring table that we use down here, is that we make you wait for 6 weeks. And if you're out of pain after 6 weeks, then you don't need treatment. The problem is, this case study of one, which is me, is that that doesn't necessarily mean your function has returned properly just because you're out of pain, because we do tend to, we learn to accommodate pain. We don't get function back, and therefore we're setting ourselves up for a longer term problem. And that's, I suppose the NHS has to have some criteria by which to judge whether to send people for contracted services, which costs them money.
Well, I mean, if you're using start back as a triage, that's wrong to begin with. Because start back actually is designed to determine, do you have psychosocial fragility and risk of chronicity, because you've got a higher psychosocial risk, not because whether you've got an acute problem or not acute problem. I've done the start back tool, yes. And I've put it in to for sciatica. And if you've got serious sciatica, and I don't know if you've ever had serious sciatica, but I've had sciatica, and it's pretty grim, and it makes you go a little bit mad. And actually, when you put in sciatica and do that instead of back pain, you score off the end of the scale. You know, you're 9. You're high risk for psychosocial chronicity. Actually, that's not. You've got a very, very organic problem, yes. and that needs to be sorted out. So using start back as a triage mechanism is wrong.
You better just run us through the start back scoring system, which is a key. It's called the Kiel start back score.
Yeah, it was developed at the University of Kiel by Nadine Foster and her team, and essentially it consists of nine questions, and then you begin with some questions that are based on the sort of physical aspect of your symptoms. So, do you have back pain? Do you have leg pain? Etc. But the more and more you go down, it becomes more about fear. So, for instance, kinesiophobia, the fear of movement, or what we used to call fear avoidance behaviour. One of the questions is, you know, do you think that if you do a lot of movement, you're going to hurt yourself? And if you answer that, then of course you're high risk for a maladaptive belief. And it's those sorts of questions. So it's driving you to say, well, do you have good beliefs or bad beliefs about your back pain? And if you've got bad beliefs about your back pain, it's likely that you're not going to get better without some sort of biopsychosocial intervention. If you score 1 or 2, you're low risk. Now, with those people, actually what's very useful is a digital management system. So there are now some systems around, and one of the companies I work with, Spring Active, we've got a digital offering. So you can actually go onto the website and you can manage your back pain digitally. The next level up from that would be a...
What do you mean by manage your back pain digitally?
No, you go onto the website and you go through the system and you actually have a look at it, and it basically says, have you got this, this and this? Okay, it is likely that this is the condition you have. You've pulled a muscle, you've got a slight bit of a disc sprain or whatever it might be, you've pulled a ligament. If you were gardening for 6 hours on Saturday and your back hurts the next day, is it surprising? No, probably not if you're 45, you've got a sort of slightly crumbly disc in there. Do you need to go and see an orthopedic surgeon? Absolutely not. Mm. But you do need to have some information about what is going on in your back. Why does it hurt so much? And spasms, the other thing that people need to understand, because if suddenly you do something and you go into spasm, it can be the most disabling symptom that you can possibly have. Yeah. And people worry that somehow it represents a catastrophe. Yeah. So if you know that it's not that, so you go onto a website and you go through all these bits and pieces and it leads you forward and gives you information about what's likely to be going on. And say, okay, try this. One, take some anti-inflammatories, take some paracetamol, you know, put a bit of heat on it, put a bit of ice on it, keep active. All those things that are in the blue book that's been out for 20 odd years, that, you know, we're back to the 1990s. Usual self-management. Most people out there don't know how to self-manage back pain. So you give them the tools, which is fine.
Instead, does everyone have access to this?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there are lots of threats. The NHS has got quite good digital resources as well. So you can go onto the web and you can find out, how do I manage my back pain? Most important thing is, don't go onto the American websites, because what they'll say is, oh, you need to go and see a neurosurgeon and then you get an operation. So that's, of course, completely wrong. But you can manage the back pain sort of really quite adequately by using these digital tools. We know then that about 40 or 50% of people within the first 2-3 weeks are going to manage completely satisfactorily with that, because they've strained their back, they've got an acute episode of back pain, most of which, like a bit like common cold, is self-limiting. So that's fine. So, and you don't need to worry about that group, as long as they've got the right digital tools to allow them to manage. The next tranche of people, they're the ones you need to sort of start to get into the system, because in that next group, they're going to be the ones you've got the higher scores on the start back. So start back really is identifying who's suitable for early physio, early osteo, or who needs to have early functional restoration.
Yeah,
that's really where it comes in.
But it struck me that we've been using this, I don't know now, for over a year, I think. And it is used effectively as a triage tool. I wouldn't say effectively.
No.
It is used as a triage tool, but it ignores the fact that patients lie.
Yes.
And a patient will go to his GP, be given a sheet of paper saying score this, knowing the patient will know what they want, and they will assume that if the score's high, they'll get that.
Yes.
And we've seen a number of patients, and you know, I've had to emphasise, you've got to be honest on this scoring system, otherwise you're going to end up going somewhere where you don't want to go. And we haven't been coaching them, but...
Yeah, I mean, it happened some years ago with hips and knees as well, whereby they to effectively ration care, they introduced some sort of preoperative scoring system as a triage. So the Oxford hip score and the Oxford knee score are the ones, and you tick the boxes, and people got to realise that the higher the score, the more likely you were to be referred into the orthopaedic clinic to actually get an X-ray to find out what's going on with your hip. And if you scored low and you're honest, then you don't get it. And the same with the back. The difference being, because the start back tool is not a triage system, actually, the more you tick the boxes, the more it says you've actually got a psychosocial problem rather than a physical problem. And that's, of course, where it falls down, because people just don't understand that what they're really saying is, I'm very, very worried about my back and I've got some maladaptive beliefs, not that I've got a genuine sciatic problem or a slip disc or whatever else. So you're right. I mean, scoring systems are, most of these things are, if it's a scoring system that's being used post-operatively for an operation, like the Oxford hip score, the Oxford knee score, it's a post-op thing. It's to look at change between pre-op and post-op. It's not a screening tool.
Right.
So, and I think primary care is probably has barked up the wrong tree slightly over the last few years with that.
So let's talk about some stuff which our audience can use in their own clinic. And it may be revision for a lot of people, but I know that I find myself on some occasions, I won't say many occasions, thinking, do I need to refer this patient or do I not? Because what constitutes a leg pain? Patients come and say, well, I'm getting pain in my glutes, or I'm getting pain down to my knee, or I'm getting pain all the way down to my ankle, or just in my ankle. Where would you start? You even mentioned corduroquine earlier, on which recent studies, I gather, have shown that the normal corduroquining screening methods are not particularly reliable or effective.
Yeah, there's a paper coming out in the Bone and Joint Journal by Nick Todd, which says exactly that. And what Nick's distinguished what are called red flags and white flags. The white flag is the white flag of surrender. It's too late. Yeah. And what Nick has pointed out, and he's a neurosurgeon from Newcastle, who has had extensive experience in corduroquine over the last 20 odd years, and he's one of the UK's leading lights in it, so he's very well qualified to talk about it. What it shows is that for many of the predictors of the outcome of corduroquine, by the time they've got incontinence, dribbling, numbness in the saddle area, bilateral sciatica, actually it may be too late. You need to be picking them up early. So if somebody's presenting to a general practitioner, to you as an osteopath, and saying, I've got pain in both my buttocks, that's a red flag, you know. And you say, well, have you got any problems passing water or controlling it, or have you noticed there's been any change? And they say, no. We say, okay, thank God, you know, not yet. Okay, any numbness around your bottom? When you wipe your bottom, can you feel it normally? And often it'll be just one side. So you get hemicorduroquine syndrome. And they'll say, yeah, it's a bit funny on one side. That's a red flag. Those are the people who should be sending straight to casualty, and within an hour they should have an MRI scan. Yeah. And if it goes to Northampton General Hospital, which is a spoke hospital without any spinal input at all, that then gets uploaded into the regional centre where somebody can look at that and they can correlate the symptoms with the MRI scan. If there's a large canal filling disc, then they have to go immediately to the local centre, and that's when they get operated on. If there isn't, and actually only about 17% of people who pitch up with what are ostensibly corduroquinar symptoms really do have corduroquinar syndrome, if it's not, then they need to have some mechanism to manage that locally. And the big problem with that is that there isn't a mechanism for a lot of places. If you go back to your first question, which is how do you decide whether somebody's got radicular pain or not, one of the definitions that the International Association for Study of Pain uses for back pain is pain between the lower ribs and the gluteal folds. The trouble with that is that sciatica starts in the buttock and it then goes anywhere down. It depends upon obviously that the nerve is affected. So I see people who've got intense buttock pain, and that is often sciatica, but it could be sacroiliac, it could be hip. There's lots of reasons for buttock pain, but you have to consider that somebody who's got buttock pain has got sciatica until proven otherwise, particularly if they've got some neurological symptoms.
That's all very well to say, but if we sent every patient we get back to the GP saying, you've got buttock pain, I need to go off and get MRI.
No, you don't need to do that, because you see, the most people is you don't need an MRI scan unless you've got red flags. So because we know that the natural history for sciatica, for disc herniation, is benign in 95% of cases, you can manage them for a few weeks. It all comes down to bothersomeness. So if your sciatica bothers you, it is bothersome. And if you want to measure that on a score of 0 to 10, then you can measure the bothersomeness.
Yes.
So it's a wonderful score. Anyway, so 0 is no bother and 10 is maximum bothersomeness. So if actually you say to somebody, so there you are, Stephen, you're coming to your clinic and you're limping in every morning and your staff are saying, oh, is your sciatica getting you again? You say, yeah, that's okay, but I've got 15 patients today, I've got to get on with it and sort of do it, and that's fine, I'll just take some anti-inflammatories, get on with it. It's obviously troublesome, but it's not so bothersome that it stops you doing stuff. If actually you're a secretary and your sciatica is so troublesome that you can't physically sit, that's quite a good indicator you need to have something done about that, because you can't sit down, that's really disabling. So I think that you can be sensible and say, okay, well, how is your sciatica? You can ask them how much pain they've got, use a visual analog score, 0 to 10. Nought's no pain, 10's the worst pain you can possibly imagine. Perhaps the sort of pain you might imagine, you've just been run down by a bus and you've got a pelvic fracture, etc., or broken legs. That works for many groups of people, not all of them, but many. So you've got that, and then you say, well, how much is it bothering you? Is it stopping? Is it keeping you awake? Because sleep deprivation is pretty grim, so that's not good. If you take painkillers, does it numb it enough for you to cope all right? Yes, it does, so I can carry on doing my normal stuff. That's fine. Okay, let's give you some treatment. That's fine. Have you got a major motor deficit? No. Major motor deficit, so foot drop, whatever, that needs scanning. So that's okay. Have you got a bit of numbness, a bit of tingling? Yes, fine. Does that worry us? Not really. A bit of numbness and tingling, it's all right. So I think you can start to sort of look at these, and you can triage them and say, okay, if it's not so bothersome, then we can actually get on and give some treatment, because we know the natural history is benign and the treatment therefore is likely to help that and to allow the patient to cope very well whilst we're sort of, if you like, buying time. And we're buying time for that presumed disc or whatever it is that's caused it just to settle down. Now, if you've got someone over the age of 60, particularly female, and they've got sciatica and you examine them and they've got a stiff back, particularly if you can feel a little step, don't try to manage that. That's a spondylolisthesis until proven otherwise. 1 in 10 women over the age of 50 will have a degenerative spondylolisthesis, and many of them will then have sciatica affecting the L5 nerve root, and that's due to quite significant stenosis. So that particular group of patients you just want to be a little bit careful of, because you don't want to be manipulating people with a spondylo, particularly if you've got tight stenosis.
No. And I suspect that most of our practitioners would be very, very cautious about going anywhere near a spondylo.
Yeah.
The difficulty is that one doesn't see that many of them, so it's not as though you feel what you know to be a spondylolisthesis very often. So we're always maybe a little bit unsure about whether we've got one or we're not. I mean, they're not necessarily easy to feel, are they?
No, they're not. It depends upon the build of the individual. I mean, so if you've got someone who's got a body mass index of 19, has got no fat on their back at all, and they've got a grade 2 spondylo at L5-S1 because they've been a gymnast when they were between 11 and 14, you've got to spot that. That's barn door. That's easy. But if you've got someone who's, body mass index of 30, and particularly in women, again, because they have the fat distribution pattern is a little different from men. Most men, like me, have a bit of a belly, and I'm pretty sort of skinny on my back, whereas women, it's actually that the fat is distributed more at the back. It's actually quite difficult to distinguish those and to see who's got a spondylo there. That said, I mean, they're quite common. So 6% of the population will have pars fractures. And most of those, they go through life and don't even know it's picked up coincidentally. And of those, a third or so will have a slip of some sort. And as a result of that, that's fine. If they pitch up with acute mechanical back pain and you don't know that they've got spondylolisthesis and you treat them, they get better. Is that a problem? No, it's not. That's absolutely fine. If they pitch up with sciatica and their L5 nerve roots are being badly affected, are you going to manipulate them if they've got rip-roaring sciatica? No, because practitioners don't do that. So by and large, the fact that they might have a spondylolisthesis doesn't matter very much, as long as they're presenting with mechanical back pain, they get better.
Sure. So maybe we ought to get on to the interesting bit, which is what you do for a living, or have done for a living, which is spinal surgery. You're going to talk about discectomy.
Yeah.
And you're going to talk about spinal fusion. which I suspect, you know, we all have a vague idea what goes on, some more than others. What's of interest to our audience is what damage is being done to this patient in the process of the operation. I mean, just how invasive is it? And then as a result of that, what can we expect to see in our clinics later for rehabilitation?
Well, if you go back some years when I started training, the situation was very different. In those days, to do a discectomy, you literally opened the back up over 6 or 8 inches. You strip the muscles off the back of the spine. It was a brutal operation. Mm. You cut all of the tendons of the multifidus off the spine's processes and then just peel the whole lot back. You put great big retractors in, so therefore you effectively you clamped the muscles and made them ischemic so they didn't work ever again. And then you counted your way up from the bottom to whichever disc you were going to get to. So that was really brutal.
And seemed a lot of chisels involved when I watched it some years back.
Yeah, usually, well, when the first boss I worked with, he had a 2-inch osteotome, which is a bit like a double-sided chisel. Instead of being sort of sharp on one side and flat on the other, it's double like that. 2-inch osteotome, and just that, you know, basically put it into the muscles and scrap and open the whole thing up. You can imagine that people are just going to be worse off rather than better if that degree of damage has gone on. And that was common. So that was the 1970s and 1980s. And then in the 1990s, we started to realize, of course, that the more damage there is, the less easy it was for them to rehabilitate. So incisions got smaller, and then smaller, smaller, smaller. And then in the early 2000s, the minimally invasive techniques started to emerge. So these are tubular approaches. And instead of you cutting muscle with a tubular approach, we've got a video that can show that. You put a guide wire in that you put down onto the bit of bone, which is where you were operating the L5 lamina or whatever it might be, and then you dilate it up. So should we play the video?
Yeah, let's look at the video. You can describe it as it goes through. So this is a 24-year-old lady?
Yeah, it's a 24-year-old lady who's got a canal-filling disc at L4-5, and she's got some degenerative change at the other levels as well. And you see there's a huge disc there at L4-5. There's an axial shock coming up, and you see that there's very little space for the cauda equina left after that. And if you have a look at that, okay, that was very quick. But anyway, it's a massive canal-filling disc. And what the video is going to show is how the patient is positioned on a surgical frame. And that's called the Wilson frame. So you have to pad them up. If you lie face down for any length of time, one of the problems you can get is pressure on your nerves, and particularly the ulnar nerve and the brachial plexus, and then the femoral nerve at the front. So this is the surgeon who's drawn a line along the spinous processes, and then is drawing a line around about a centimetre or 1.5 centimetres lateral to that. They put a needle in to then be able to take an X-ray to show them exactly where they are. So that's the marker. And having done that, he's going to draw a line that's no more than 1.5 centimetres, maybe 2 centimetres, incise the skin with a scalpel. This is where the blood comes out, but there's very little blood with this. It's a virtually bloodless operation. And then in goes the guide pin, and he's going to dock that onto the bone of the level that he wants to operate. In this case, it's L4-5, so he wants to be either on the L4 or the L5 lamina, whichever he chooses is his marker.
Is this being radiologically guided as well?
Yes, so they have an X-ray device in theatre called an image intensifier. So that's why. And then over that, he starts to put some dilating devices, and each of these is slightly bigger than the last one. And what it does is it spreads the muscle. Instead of tearing and damaging the muscle, it spreads it apart. It looks a bit brutal, but actually it's a very gentle way to create a portal. And then at the last one he puts in there, it'll be about a 2 centimetre portal. He then clamps to the table, takes it all out, and then way out, there you go. That's the tube there, shows you pointing at L4-5. He then brings the microscope in, and you can't do this without a microscope. The key to the microscope is you get binocular vision and good illumination. So here is clearing the rest of the muscle off the interlaminar space, and underneath you begin to see the yellowness. There's the yellowness of the ligamentum flavum. This is you get to see a burr there. So there's a high-speed burr running about 20,000 RPM, and he's going to burr off a bit of the bone from the lamina, which is on the left side. That's cranial, and then coming towards us towards the bottom of the picture. That's the medial aspect of the facet joint. So you do a little bit of a facet burring off there. And that yellow stuff, you see the ligament there. So this is a blunt tip probe. He's just going to slide that underneath that bit of bone. He wants to take that off. That's a punch called a kerosene. So he's going to nibble away those bits, and his assistant is hopefully going to nicely keep the field clear of the blood. It's not a particularly bloody operation, but if you've not got the patient in the right position, because the veins can get compressed in the abdomen, it can be pretty grim. So here's the burr, and that's all those little bits of bone shards, so they'll be taken away. Then the next thing you're going to see is that little probe just peels the ligamentum flavum off the underside of the lamina, and then it divides it, and then you begin to see the fat just underneath that ligamentum flavum, and let's clear a little bit more of that. And then you're going to start to see the nerves, and you'll see the dural sheath. There we are. So there you begin to see that sort of slightly glistening thing on the left-hand side. So he's taking the punch and getting rid of that ligamentum flavum. And then the nerves are going to be tightly compressed over that huge disc. There's a bit more burring there. Have to be a bit careful. Once the canal's open and you've got the burr in your hands, you don't want to slip, otherwise you do catastrophe. So you see the little vessels there on that glistening, bulging thing. Well, that's the dura. So now what he wants to do is to put a little probe in and feel the medial aspect of the pedicle so he knows where the nerve root is. And then he can slide a little, there you are, a little probe underneath the nerves and push them away. And there's a nerve root retractor. That's the bulging disc. It's got a few veins on it. So the nerve has been retracted by probably no more, because it's microscope, no more than about 8 or 9 millimeters. So it's not a big hole. So he uses some cautery to make a bloodless field. And then takes a knife and puts a cruciate incision into the disc. And then having done that, what you're going to find is that great big bulging disc has come out in pieces. There are two very large pieces. And you put a little grabber down, a pituitary rongeur. And the other thing that what he's doing with that nerve retractor is pushing downwards. And that, there you are, it helps to deliver the disc, a bit like a little baby coming out. And that's the piece of disc there. And there's another big piece. There we are. That's the huge bit that came out there. And often
that's all annulus.
No, that's nucleus. That's the nuclear fragment. So he's now probing underneath. The annulus is that stuff there you see. He's got the probe underneath, that floppy stuff. That's the annulus. Yep. So he's probing to make sure there are no other bits of disc material there. He's then going to probe up into the rest of the spinal canal, through into the foramen, make sure everything's clear there. There's the probe going up, make sure there are no other loose fragments. And then having done that, what he wants to do is to make sure that there is hemostasis, so he irrigates it with lots of saline. He'll put a little bit of, that's a little sponge, what's called a patty, just down to pat it dry. You don't want to have bleeding after this operation, otherwise it compresses the nerve. That's a little bit of steroid on some foam there. And then having done that, he's going to take out the tube, leaves a little bit of gel foam in there, which is a coagulant material just between the muscles there. And then he's going to sew it up. And there we are. He sews it up, and he's got a 2 centimeter incision. That's a day case operation. So you come in at 7 in the morning, have your operation at 9:30. You should be home by 4:30 and ready to have tea. And up and moving around. There's virtually no damage there. There we are, tiny. So that's the end of that. Thanks, Michael.
And the patient will be up and walking.
So the patient should be walking within 2 hours of the surgery.
2 hours?
Yeah. Right. So with modern multimodal analgesia, the key is that you give them pain control before the operation. Because we know that as soon as you stick a knife into somebody, you generate neurological pain. So if you now, we've got it worked out, if you give them gabapentin or some other neurological painkiller as a pre-med, and then you give it to them for a couple of doses afterwards, you can virtually eliminate post-operative pain, so you can get them up walking. In the same way that you can, for knee replacements, for instance, if you irrigate a knee with local anesthetic and then you put local anesthetic all around it and you give them neurological painkillers, you can get them doing a 0 to 90 degree bend within half an hour of waking up in recovery, and they can go home the same day. So we've got a trial, there's a trial in Glasgow of people having knee replacements, day case knee replacements, because they can do that. So if you can control the pain, they can get up and get home. This person, of course, having had coming in limped with serious sciatica, is going to go home without that pain, and that cut in the back hardly hurts. So to go home the same day is no problem at all.
What is now left between the vertebrae?
Well, the same as what was before, because that disc was actually extruded, and so there's a, so you've got a degenerate disc that has, because it has dried out, the nucleus has fragmented, there has become, the annulus has obviously then collapsed down and bulges out, and there's an annular tear, and it's these fragments of nucleus that find their way out through the annular tear, then sit in the spinal canal. Take those away, and you just got a degenerate disc that's still there. It's just degenerate, and it'll function very well. The big problem is there's a hole in the back of that disc, and that hole where that fragment's come out, now that the blood can get to it, you can get a scar forming there, so that the whole thing can then gum up. That's fine, make it more stable. Yeah. But if you get another fragment of disc that comes out, if you're too active too quickly, another fragment of disc can then come out through that same hole, so you get a recurrence. So in normal discs, if you've got a disc hernia that's managed conservatively, you've got about a 4% chance of getting a recurrence in the next year. When you've had a discectomy, it's about a 10% chance.
Yeah.
So because you've actually got the hole in the annulus.
Right. Now, of course, what's going through my mind is that there's got to be a loss of disc height there.
Yep.
Because there is no disc, and therefore the foramina presumably are narrowed, and therefore there is a serious problem here with nerve root compression, is that not?
Well, not necessarily, because the foramen is quite a big strain, it's quite a big hole. Mm. You can have a serious foraminal narrowing and not have much in the way right. of stenosis. So it all depends upon the size and the shape of the canal. We know that there are a range of human sizes. So there's quite a lot of people who have a congenitally narrow canal, and they may have quite narrow foramen. And for them, if you then have a large disc like this that comes out, yes, foraminal stenosis may well be a problem. And for them, actually, the only way you can treat that is by doing some sort of operation to re-establish the disc height, or to do a massive decompression of the of the foramen.
Yeah.
So that's either a big decompression bilaterally, or you do a spinal fusion and you jack everything out and you put it all together again. And it may well be that's actually quite a reasonable indication for a spinal fusion, that you've had a discectomy and you've then gone on to have what's called a post-discectomy instability. That is, you've got recurrent pain in the back, in the legs because of stenosis. So what you're going to do is going to deal with that mechanically. Now, if you've got primary foraminal stenosis, so a degenerate disc, and you know, so a 65-year-old, 70-year-old man who's come in with sciatica and claudication, you're probably only going to do a decompression on that person because they've not come in with a sort of a chronic history of back pain. So depending upon how they present will depend upon the operation you do.
Okay.
But you're right. I mean, you know, you can get quite rapid collapse. But there are some people who have huge spinal canals and who will never get foraminal stenosis. And then there are most people in the middle. So,
what happened to this 24-year-old? 24, very young, isn't it, for some people?
Yeah, you can see that. She had three discs that are degenerate. One, which is a canal-filling disc hernia. That's a genetic problem. So we were involved in a big multinational trial looking at the genetics of disc degeneration called the GenoDisc Project some years ago. And what the GenoDisc Project has shown is that 70% of the changes in your discs are inherited, and 30% is what you have in life. So there's the genetic component, that's 70%, and the epigenetic component is 30%. So for instance, you have a rubbish set of genes that means that all of your discs are degenerate, and they start off at a young age, and it can be teens. I see a lot of teenagers with degenerate discs, and that's genetic. So by the time you're 24, you've got two or three discs that are not working very well. And then you decide that you want to play rugby, and is it likely that your discs are going to become more symptomatic? The answer is yes. If you're born with a really good set of genes and you've got fantastic discs, you can go off and be a coal miner and spend your life down the mines and never have back pain. So the interplay is very much the genetics and epigenetics, and it's 70% is genetic. So she, you could see, has a genetic problem.
So we should be screening people young to make sure they don't do things to aggravate their potential disc problems.
I think the problem with that is that the implication of screening, if you have a screening test, it needs to be cheap.
Yes.
And it needs to be effective, and it needs to pick up the ones that are going to be be relevant. And none of those apply, because the only screening test we've actually got for discs is an MRI scan. A, it's not cheap, and B, the relevance of an MRI scan and your symptoms is highly variable. We know that in some people they'll have a scan that's completely normal, but the patient's got lots of back pain. And other people, they'll have lots of discs that are degenerate and they have no back pain at all. So the correlation between a scan and your symptoms is variable at best and absent at worst. That's the real problem. So,
what rehab did this young lady go through?
I don't know, actually, because that was a film from a colleague. I think it is likely that they'd have had a walking program. And if we say, what rehab would my patient go through? Then the answer is they get up and they do a walking program. The most important thing is they do a paced rehab program. So you start off with 400, 500 meters twice a day. So they do two walks a day, and they do a bit of resting, and they do some core exercises, and they're shown the core exercises in hospital by the physiotherapist. Ideally, they should be shown, if they can be, before they come into hospital. And certainly patients who have the biggest spinal operations, they will have a preemptive education program so that they know what to do before they come in. But for a discectomy, when they might be coming in very fresh, very acute, and in a lot of pain, you can't really get through to them what the right exercise program is. So they then see the physiotherapist. The physiotherapist will give them four or five very simple exercises to do. And the most important thing is keep moving. But between your exercise program, rest, certainly for the first week. And then, having done that, 400-500 meters twice a day, then they go up and they double that to 800 meters twice a day, and they do it for 7 days, maybe 5 days if they're really fit, but so 5-7 days, and then they step up and they do that and they don't go any higher, because if you try to do too much too quickly, you get boom and bust, and the long and short of it is you can't rehab that way. So you have a paced rehabilitation program, which means that after 4 weeks they should be able to walk 2 miles twice a day. We know that walking is one of the best exercises for the back. It's very gentle. It exercises the muscles in a symmetrical and nice way. So that's fine. At 4 weeks, having done the gentle physical walking and the exercises, at that stage, I would then get them back to see a specialist spinal physiotherapist for proper work, because they're likely to be in defunction. What you said earlier about having had an acute episode of pain, and the pain goes away, but does the function come back?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. Because actually your function has dropped off. Your pain might have disappeared, but because your function's dropped off, it means that next time round, you can have a lower threshold to have a loss of function again. So you need to rebuild that function. These people, however minimally invasive the operation was, they need to have that function rebuilt.
Yeah. And people will think that this is one of my hobby horses. It's not really, but one of the things that I quite like about walking as an exercise, of course, is that it is functional. It's what you need your back to do. Whereas there are those who are sceptical of core stability exercises, which I think you mentioned core exercises earlier on, which are specific to muscle groups where there is actually not a great deal of evidence to say that this translates to function later.
Well, you're absolutely right. Funny enough, it was a discussion we had last week at an academic meeting in Southampton, saying that now a lot of the Pilates groups, particularly the sort of body control and those bigger ones, they're moving away from discussing core. And actually they've realised that it's not the whole story. Duncan Critchley was a physiotherapist at the RNOH in 1994, was first doing it, and I remember being part of his trials and having to lie on his bench with a 1 litre saline bag that was then sort of inflated with air, and having to arch my back and make sure that I could then push this down, which was, you know, a certain manometer was giving a certain amount of pressure. And then they were measuring with an ultrasound the transversus activation. Okay, so that was the story of the mid-1990s. And then the mid-2000s, it's sort of wrapping around the corset and all that, etc. Here we are in 2015, and people begin to realize, actually, and they're saying, well, okay, you need good muscles, but actually you need the totality of it, not just the transversus, not this, not that, and it's not just pelvic floor. You need it functionally, as you say, and you need a balance between the front and the back. You need a balance between the intrinsic muscles, so that's those that are directly attached to the spine, and the extrinsic ones, so the ones that are acting outside. And most importantly, you need to make sure is what the patient needs to do in their normal life.
Yeah.
So if they're a secretary or a lawyer or anybody else who spends a lot of time sitting, they need to be able to sit in a balanced way. Actually, for them, the core is quite good. Because when I'm sitting in my clinic, and I have to do that obviously for, you know, probably 18 hours in a week, then if I pull my tummy in, it stops me getting thoracic back pain. Because otherwise I slouch like this, because that's the usual thing, isn't it? So that's actually functional, sitting like that. And some of these stools that you sit on that make you actually sit in this nice position are quite helpful for that. But that's no good if you're a shop worker. If you're a shop worker and you're either filling shelves, or more importantly, something I've realised recently is actually when you're at the checkout, how physical that is. So if you've got that position there, then you've got to take for instance, a leg of lamb that's come along the conveyor belt, lift it up here, scan it, and put it like that. What are the functional muscles that allow you to do that? Well, it's not necessarily just the core, is it? Because you've got to activate everything else down here, and they've got to be fit for purpose. Yes. So I think you're absolutely right. I think we are moving into a phase where function is going to become much more important. And of course, walking exercises, all of the muscles that you need for most functions.
I'm going to put in a plug here for a good friend of mine, Professor A. Lederman, who is, his doctorate is in physiotherapy. He's also trained as an osteopath, but his great mantra is that rehabilitation must be functional, whether it's neurological or whether it's post-operative. Yeah. And he's actually running a course on the 31st of January, just north of London, in Huntingdon, and he'll be training those people who'd like to come along in just what we've been discussing here. So well worth doing, because it is a much better approach to exercise, in his opinion, and my opinion as well, and now we've learned yours, to rehabilitation after injury, not just surgery. We've got some questions that have come in, which I've been studiously ignoring, because I've been fascinated by the videos and what you've said. But you mentioned earlier on that 1 in 10 women over 50 will have a spondylolisthesis. And the question is, where does that research come from? Because clearly our viewer hadn't seen that.
Oh, I mean, that's been well known. I mean, I can't remember when it was first published. I suspect it was back in 1968 when Wiltsey and Newman McNabb first described the various types of spondylolisthesis. But we've known from longitudinal studies since then. And it all comes down to the female pelvis. So this is a degenerate spondylolisthesis. This is not the isthmic type, which is the type that you get when you're a teenager from repetitive bending forwards and backwards. So that's gymnasts and fast bowlers, etc. Yeah. So this is a degenerate spondylolisthesis. The incidence in women is 1 in 10, and the incidence in, that's over the age of 50, and the incidence in men over the age of 60 is 1 in 30. Why the difference? Well, the difference is actually because the position of the L4-5 level in relation to the pelvic brim. The L4-5 level has to be effectively higher up for women so that they can then get the head engaged when they deliver babies. That's what it comes down to. It's all about pregnancy. In men, the L4-5 level is much more set down within that. So the iliolumbar ligaments effectively stabilize it. So it's much less likely. So that's the reason why they get it. And the numbers are, I can't think what the paper was. It would have been like the 1990s. Yeah. But there's an epidemiological paper that shows exactly what the numbers are, and it hasn't changed. If 1 in 10 women have it, only 1 in 10 of those are going to need to have some sort of serious treatment. So you know, for the majority of women, 90% of them, you know, who might have it, that's fine, but you don't need anything doing about it. Yeah. Or some core exercises.
Somebody's coming back to the business of removing the nucleus. Yeah. And the question is, why don't you stuff something in its place to replace that?
Well, that's been tried.
Cushioning substance.
Yeah, it's been tried. So most of us who've got a few grey hairs, or even if we've bald, had grey hairs, have tried disc repair techniques. So, for instance, I tried something called the PDN, prosthetic disc nucleus. So this was a hydrogel pellet surrounded by a wove-on Dacron sleeve. And the idea was that when the disc came out, because it had degenerated, and you put this thing back in, and that would then act as a replacement disc. And the hydrogel swells up the water, and then when you compress it, the water comes out. So it behaves just like the nucleus does, and that's the idea. The trouble with that is there's a great big hole in the back of that disc. What you put in can easily come out again. And if it comes out and then prangs your nerves and gives you corticotropic syndrome, it's pretty useless. So we went through the phase of things like that. There was a thing called Synox. Synox was that was a better one, because what that was is an injectable polymer. So once you've taken those fragments of the disc out and you cleared out any other loose fragments, you put a little nozzle in the disc and you fill the disc space up with this injectable polymer that then set. Again, a bit like a rubbery compound. The problem is that it wouldn't last more than a few weeks or a few months. By the time the patient had been up and around and compressed it a few thousand times, it fragmented, out it came, into the nerves again, etc. So Synox disappeared. There was something called Dascor. That was very promising, but the problem with that was the company went bust before it could get it to market. So they've all been tried. The latest one is a device whereby you can do an annular repair, and you actually physically put a spiky thing into the annulus and literally close it up again. But for most of us, putting a spiky thing into the spine and somewhere near the nerves is fairly scary. And what happens if it comes loose? You know, if it is going to lacerate nerves, are you going to have a problem? So that hasn't yet got much traction. So it has been tried, and nothing yet has worked sufficiently well to recommend it.
It would seem to me that it is an area of an attractive area for research for companies, given the prevalence of back pain. So I presume there is still some more research going on.
Yeah, I suspect there's been $500 or $600 million worth of research into this very project problem over the last 10, 12 years. That's how much money's been thrown at it, and they still haven't got an answer. And the reason for that is because the disc is very complicated.
Yeah.
Because once the disc has changed and has gone through its degenerative cascade, then it's not just the nucleus that's changed, but the annulus has changed as well. So you therefore have this really complicated system whereby the container isn't working as well as it should do. The internal structural part, the shock absorber, if you like, that's all gone. So how do you replace the whole thing? Well, you can do a disc replacement, and lumbar disc replacements went through their heyday from 2004 through to 2007. Everybody was doing disc replacements. But why did it die a death? Well, it died a death because, one, you had to go through the front of the spine to do it, which is a big operation through the front, moving all the blood vessels around and then taking the disc out. Two, the technology wasn't fully worked out, so there are lots of failures. Three, when you've got a failure through the front, if that ruptures your aorta, you're dead. And if you do a revision operation where it's all scarred down and you tear the blood vessels, you're dead. And there were young people who were having these operations, having revisions, and they were dying. And there are class actions in the States going on against some of the companies that were peddling these discs. So there are one or two discs around still that are still used in very, very limited numbers for this sort of thing. But you've really got to pick the winner. It's a difficult area, it really is. There has been lots of research. None of it yet has given us an answer.
So what do we do to preserve a bit of space between the discs?
Between
the vertebrae?
We don't care about it. What we want is we want a disc that is going to bear load effectively, because part of the problem is that back pain comes about because the disc doesn't bear load efficiently. So it's not about movement. It's not an instability. Isn't movement as such. You know, there may be some instabilities like spondylolisthesis where there's a movement problem. But by and large, it's when you get out of the chair and do that, you're loading your disc. That's when it hurts. So the first thing is you want a disc that's loading symmetrically and efficiently, not one that's loading around the rim. And if you can do that, then that's fine. So good muscles. And you want to actually, when you've had a discectomy, what you want is that disc collapse down a bit more. Because if it collapses down a bit more, it becomes a bit more stable, a bit stiffer. Yeah. Which is fine. Given that we cannot rejuvenate discs, so we can't put them back to where they were, you've got to say, well, what's the next best thing? Well, the next best thing is a stable degenerate disc. And as long as you haven't got any nerve roots that are being pinched, so what we said earlier about foraminal stenosis, that's absolutely fine. So you have a nice, stable, degenerate disc, doesn't give you a backache or maybe sort of, you know, a little bit of symptoms, but not very often. And that's fine. That's a tolerable situation for most people. In fact, you may or may not know what your back looks like, but you may have one or more discs like that right now. Yeah. Are you in a lot of trouble? No, you're not. You're coping very well, because actually it's a fairly efficient system. You might be a bit stiff in the morning. You might not be able to do the things you did when you were 20, that's fine, but that doesn't matter. So,
is that one of the difficulties with sending patients for MRI? Because if they are told that there is a bulging disc, will they then seek surgery? Or do you find patients do accept the fact that lots of people have got these and there's no need for surgery unless you're getting serious symptoms that matter?
That is a problem. And the problem is that if you've got open access to MRI scan in primary care, and you are requesting a test which you have no mechanism to be able to interpret in a sensible way, then the patients are going to get very, at least, mixed messages and potentially the wrong message. So Mr. GP, who organises an MRI scan, if she or he is unable to then look at that scan and make a sensible interpretation of what is on that scan in relationship to the patient in front of them, that scan's pretty useless, because all it's going to do is have a bit of paper, usually comes from somewhere else in the world, because that's what teleradiology is, and it'll basically say, you've got degenerate level at L1-2, L2-3, L3-4, and you've got pinching here, and you've got that there, a disc bulge there, and there's that, And everybody goes, oh my God, you know, I've got to completely crap back. Actually, you're functioning very well. You've got a little bit of sciatica, and that's because you've got a little bit of L4-5 stenosis. So you're absolutely right. The widespread use of MRI scan is a double-edged sword, because MRIs are fantastic, but they need to be interpreted. Yeah. So if you can't interpret them in the light of what the patient's got, they can be pretty useless. Yeah. In fact, they can be positively, you can't be positively useless, can you? You can be sort of negative.
Yeah. The one of the questions that's come in is, are the facet joints themselves more at risk after the sort of surgery we've just seen?
Well, it depends on how you define more at risk. If your disc height is reduced, and therefore you do not have the ability for your facet joints to glide in the usual way, they're going to have to take more pressure. There's no doubt about it. So they will become hypertrophied. They have to react to that. So they become a bit arthritic, bigger hypertrophied. That's a problem for a small number of people, but it certainly is a problem. And you see it some years down the line, because these things take a little while to develop. And that is that if the disc reduces in height and the facets then become hypertrophied, and you've got a relatively small spinal canal, that's the situation that you alluded to earlier, where they are going to get both up-down stenosis, that's the loss of disc height, but also because the facet joint's bulky, they get front-back stenosis as well. Mm. And that foramen is going to be at risk. So yes, in a small group of people, after a discectomy, many years down the line, those facet joints may actually start to cause some serious trouble.
But in those many years, they've probably had a much improved quality of life, I presume.
Well, except that discectomies are for relatively acute events, aren't they? Mm. So, you know, are they going to be... Well, if they'd had a disc that had got better by itself, which 95% of them do, is it going to be the same? Probably. So, you know...
That's a good point, isn't it? How do you judge the outcomes of the treatments that you administer? I mean, we're looking at that surgery there. It's going to be many years before we might see the consequences of that surgery, perhaps, and you won't know necessarily whether those consequences are due to that particular intervention.
No. Well, I mean, there are a number of ways. I mean, because you think about outcomes, I mean, you've got to start to decide, do you want to measure outcome by what you and I think is important? So basically a sort of a physician-derived score. So for instance, the Oswestry Disability Score or the Rowland-Morris Disability Score or the SF36 scores, those are sort of, sort of specialist-derived scores. Or do you actually take it as what the patient thinks is important? Yeah. The patient thinks is important is function. Yeah. And functional scores, I think, are much more important. So you ask the patient, A, did it work for you? Yeah, it got rid of my sciatica, thanks very much, doc. And, I'm back to work as a bricklayer, whatever else. That's absolutely fine. And would you recommend it to a friend or family? So, you know, the old net promoter score. Would you recommend it to a friend or family? Would you have it again in similar circumstances? So if the answer to those three questions is yes, that's a good operation. Yeah. Does it matter what their Oswestry score is? Probably not, if they're back to their previous job. If they can't get back to their job, then it's not a good operation. Yeah. So that's one thing. If it leads inevitably 10 years down the line to them not having their employment retention, because actually you know that the intervention you do today is inevitably going to lead to a catastrophic failure of their spine in 10 years' time, that's not a good intervention. We don't have that long longitudinal data, unfortunately.
In your experience, this question says, how long does it take for an acute disc to self-resolve?
That's a piece of string. The best data we've got came from Leiden, so it was Professor Wilco Poole's unit in Holland, and that was a paper published in 2007, New England Journal of Medicine. And what they did was the randomised controlled trial of people with sciatica with a proven disc herniation. And what they showed was that you treat them either non-operatively, or if at 6 weeks they've got bothersome pain, then you do a discectomy. And they followed the group out to 52 weeks. And what they showed was that 95% of both groups at 52 weeks had complete resolution of their symptoms. The difference is that the operative group got better quicker. It's a reason. If you plot the curve between cure here and time there, it's a reasonably flat curve. It's almost sort of 45 degrees for conservative treatment, maybe a little bit sort of front-loaded. So, you know, quite a lot of people, 60, 70%, are going to be much better with an acute disc herniation within 6 to 8 weeks. But there might be a little tail of them getting better. It might take 3, 4 months. If they're better by 6 weeks, that's fine. If they're not better by 6 weeks, how likely are they to be better by, say, 3 months? Well, another 10%. By the time you get to 6 months, probably 25-30% of patients left, and they will take another 6 months to get better. So it's a reasonably predictable recovery rate. The important thing is, if they have a disc herniation clinically, and then you prove that with an MRI scan, and they're getting better, do you need to intervene? No. Well, if they're not getting better, what can you do? Well, there's lots of non-invasive or minimal invasive things you do. So for instance, you can do some stretching, you can do some flossing, you can do some exercises, all of which is shown to be effective in managing sciatica, that's fine. You can do some traction. So there's a thing called a DRX 9000 machine, which is a wonderful device. It's when you strap it into this great big device about the size of this room, and the computer then stretches the back. And there are one or two clinics around in the UK that do that. And they say you have to go back every day for 30 days, and that will treat your acute disc. And in the States, there are lots of them in Florida. It's $100 a pop. So it's $3,000 for the treatment. But it's effective, you know, and they've got published data that says it's effective. You can do injections, so you can do a nerve root block or epidurals. What that does is it reduces the pain, so it buys you time to allow the disc to resolve. Because most discs resolve, because the nucleus that comes out is a foreign material. So the immune system sees it, if you like, as a foreign invader, mounts an immune response against it. And if you take serial MRI scans, most of these discs just disappear. Because the nucleus is gone, so that's why. And even ones like that lady there with a big canal fitting disc, a huge disc, you can leave those as long as they've not got cord required symptoms, and as long as they're not so bothered by it that they can't function, and actually they will resolve as well. So is there a predictable time course for resolution of disc herniations? Yes, there is, and the listeners can go to the New England Journal of Medicine 2007, Wilco Poole, P-E-U-L, his paper. So
we'll look at that and we'll put the reference up on the website.
I'll send it to you. I'll let you have that, because I've got the paper and you can have that and they can all read that. So it's a great study, and there are some follow-on studies from that, but it's all out there.
Traction works. What about inversion tables?
I recommend inversion table for some people. I reckon it works in about 50% of people who've got a combination of back pain and leg pain that comes about as a result of foraminal stenosis. Right. And what I say to people is without plugging Amazon, there's actually one that you can buy on Amazon. It's about 100 quid. And I say, look, if it works for you, that's brilliant. If it doesn't, flog on eBay.
Find someone else it works for.
Yeah, exactly. But at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, traction, DRX 9000 is an expensive way. If you can buy something for £100, and if you can actually tolerate being inverted at, I don't know, 45, 50 degrees, whilst you read your Kindle for 15, 20 minutes a day, if that manages your back pain and leg pain, job's good. That's fine. Yeah. Because it means you keep out of the hands of Mr. Chop-a-Lot. Because what Mr. Chop-a-Lot wants to do is put a hole in your back, and that then leads to a whole bunch of other things that you don't really necessarily want.
So you're saying that for some spinal consultants, that if you go with back pain, their immediate response will be, let's chop it out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the best example of that is the Germanic model. In Germany and in America, they do 10 times as many spinal operations per head of population as we do. They're very, very invasive and aggressive. They don't have a concept of the biopsychosocial model by and large. What they do is they see somebody's got back pain, plus minus leg pain. They have an MRI scan, they have a black disc, and they say you need to have an operation.
You're implying that our model's better?
I think our model's different. Mm-hmm. So the question is there actually a right level of operative intervention for lumbar spine conditions? And there is a right level. Where is it? Is it at the bottom end where we are and Sweden is? Or is the top end, which is America and Germany? America and Germany overoperate. There's no doubt about that. And they massively overoperate. But it's fee for service. So when you look at the healthcare systems, that is often what will drive the level of intervention. Now, in terms of who's right or wrong, we'll argue in the poll afterwards.
Two quick questions, and we've got another video which I'm sure people are delighted to see, and we are going to run out of time before long. First of all, what's flossing?
Oh, flossing. Right, flossing is making a nerve move. So essentially, when you think about your nerve, it starts at the brain, it goes down to your big toe. And one of the problems with sciatica is that the nerve gets tethered. So that if the disc is sitting here and your S1 nerve root comes around it and it gets tethered, every time you move your leg, it hurts and you get sciatica. Yeah. So if you can make your nerve glide, then that will then relieve a lot of that sciatic pain. So when you floss, what you do is you get the patient to, essentially, it's a bit like the old sort of nodding donkey in the car, and that is that you get them to lean forward and then get the head up there. So you put tension through the spinal cord and the brain, and then you get them to put their leg out. So it's a bit like a slump test. Yes. And they start to get, as soon as they get the bite, the pain, head goes back and the leg comes up, and then head forward until they get a bit of pain, and then it goes down like that. And what you're doing is essentially you use the whole of the central nervous system and the nerve to slide up and down. It's just like flossing your teeth, but it's flossing your nerve.
Thank you to the person who asked that question, because I think there are a lot of us who wondered and didn't like to express our.
But it has to be done properly, and you need to see your very good local spinal flosser to find out how to do it. But you don't need a kid.
Let me see if we've got time for these other questions after we've watched this video.
Okay.
We're out of time. If not, then I'll ask you the questions, get the answers, right, and we'll post them on the website. But this is about spinal fusion.
Yeah, so what the video shows effectively is a modern method of doing a spinal fusion. Traditionally, spinal fusions involve opening the spine up over a big area, and you see here they put the marker on. It's only a couple of centimeters with a little retractor in there. They've already done some of the work there, and what it's doing is sucking around the dura, and you can see the spinous processes that run from about 2 o'clock down to 8 o'clock. And there's a gap in there, and there's a little bit of pale stuff, and that's the dura underneath. So he's done a decompression there, and what he's going to do is to remove the contents of the disc and then replace that with a plastic device called a cage. And the cage is essentially an open weave plastic box that you can put some bone grafting material into. That then takes up the space of the disc itself. And then you need to have some sort of clamp on the back. And in this case, he's going to put some percutaneous screws and also a clamp, what's called an interspinous clamp, on the back. So right now, he's making sure that the nerves are all free, and then he's going to move them slightly to one side so that he can then attack the disc and take the contents of the disc out. That's called a discectomy. It was a nucleotomy rather than discectomy. We have to wait until he's got that. So there he has moved all the quarter quina towards the midline. That thing with the green fingers on it, that is a sucker and a retractor. And that's holding the whole of the quarter quina back. Now he's putting a thing into the disc itself. And this is where you get brutal, because he's going to hammer that in. So this is not for squeamish people, this sort of surgery. But that was a device to go into the disc and then to start to free that up. And what you'll then see is you put a grabber in and it'll pull out fragments of disc. There we are. These are fragments of disc. That's it. That's what a degenerate disc looks like. Normal disc is healthy. It looks a bit like crab meat. It's white and it's sticky and it's got lots of fluid in it. This is all degenerate stuff. So he's then put a device in to free that disc up, take out all these loose fragments, and then he's going to roar up. There you go. He's got a nice sharp thing in his hand. He's going to hit that with a hammer. That's the scary thing about spinal surgery, because it's very, very close to structures that are very important. So he's going to use that to free up the disc, take away a few of the osteophytes on the edge of the disc, edge of the vertebrae, and then prepare the space so he can put his cage in. And the cage is just a spacer. The important thing about the cage is, as I say, it's an open weave box. So it's the bone grafting material you put inside. And he also will put bone graft around the cage. So he'll put bone graft into the disc itself first, and then put the cage in. And the scary bit comes when you see him hammering the cage with a hammer. So that was him hitting his little chisel, effectively, to take off a few osteophytes. So suck all those little bits and pieces. Okay, now this is him putting the bone graft in. So he's taken out all of the degenerate disc material, and that stuff there is the bones of dead Americans. That's called DBM, or MUDA, as one of my friends call it, mashed up dead Americans. So DBM is demineralized bone matrix. It comes from cortical bone that then is put into a vat of acid. and the calcium is digested away with the acid, and it leaves a mush of collagen and bioactive molecules that allow bone to grow. So that's a commercially available bone graft substitute. So he's packed that in using a funnel, and that's then gone into the front of the disc, and he's compacted that down, and then he's going to put his cage in to sit just behind that, and that then allows the disc to fuse up. So the cage acts as a spacer, and the bone graft around and within the cage then allows it to grow together. So
how long does that process take?
Well, the growing,
yeah,
usually a year. So you can sometimes see people have fused at 6 months, but majority of them fused at a year. And with these modern techniques, you're getting a sort of 93 to 95% fusion rate, as opposed to the old fusion rates, which are sort of down to 60%. So anyway, this is him with a hammer. Now, he's put his cage in, which you didn't see. He's now tapping it to push it round the corner. So what's happened is it's gone in straight, so in the AP direction, but he wants to make it sit transversely. So he's tapped it with his little tamp. And that's then got around the corner. So he's now done the bit at the front through the back. You can do this through the front. You can actually open up the abdomen, take out the disc from the front, and that's quite a good way. And you see that white thing in there? That's the back of the cage. That's a plastic device, and that's that. So I think he's going to get his little tamp on. He's warning us not to be too aggressive, I think. So that's him talking about turning the cage round. So he's put it in an AP direction, and he wants to make it transverse. So he's going to put his little tap on here and hit it with a hammer quite hard. There we are. That's the tap. They're quite big instruments, aren't they? Yeah. Whack, 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 whack. Now, if he gets that wrong, that's a paralyzed patient. So you can tell he's...
There didn't seem to be much science to it, to be honest.
There's a lot of science to it, actually. It's quite interesting. The thing about orthopedics is that you can't do orthopedics without hammers and saws and drills because you're dealing with bony structures. And of course, that's what he's trying to do. So he's put that cage in. Of course, it's a very tight fit because you have to have a tight fit. That's what you want. And to move the cage, you've got to hit it hard to get into that space. So anyway... I'm sure he'll reassure us that the patient was fine. Now, this is putting some screws in. He made another little incision just above the first one. And like that first operation, he's going to put a little wire down and then some dilating tubes. And through that, he's then going to pass two screws, one on each side, that go through the facet joints. And what they do is they transfix the facet joints. And then, because they've got what's called a lag screw concept, and what that does is it compresses the facet joint together. And you can take the cartilage, the facet joint out, and it shows you that later on. He burrs that out, drills it out, puts a bit of bone graft into it, and you can compress it, and that gives you good fusion of the facet joints. And so he's now got a device in the disc that's taken away. He's going to have fixation with facet joints. That's what this is. And then the last bit is going to put a clamp on the spinous processes. So where's to take that bit of the ligament out between the spinous processes? He's then going to put a spiky thing on, but you'll see there's a clamp, and that's got an interspinous clamp. So that's a drill, and he's drilling down a wire through the guide channel and under X-ray control, and he's going to drill it across the facet joints. And then having put the wire in, he then takes the tube out, and over that he puts a big screw that's about 4 millimeters across with a very sharp end, and there we are. So he's going to grip the wire so that when he takes everything off, the wire stays where it's supposed to be. He's just checking on the X-ray now, making sure where he is. There's the X-ray. And that shows you then that the wire, there it is, there's the wire in the drill. That's gone down into the S1 facet, the vertebra, through the facet joint. So he's done that. And then he's putting his little dilator over that. Make sure that he can get in. And that's probably also a tap. Yeah, he's tapping the hole to create a screw thread in exactly the same way as you use tap and dies in the metalwork, as we all did when we were at school. So that's that. What he's now doing also is he's running some electricity through there. And that's a little bit of neural monitoring. So he's making sure that where he's gone hasn't come in contact with the nerve. And he can look at the a screen to tell you exactly what's happening with the nerves down the legs. This is him now taking what's called a diathermy, which is a coagulation device. He's taking the capsule off the facet joint, and then he's going to put a burr in that to take away all the cartilage, and then pack a little bit of bone material in there just to allow that to fuse up. So you'll see the screw going across there in a second. I think that's his burr. So this is the high-speed burr, 20,000 RPM burr with a little diamond tip on it, and that's all the bone graft and bone dust that's been created there. And what that does is, to get a fusion, you have to have raw bone surfaces, because bones... Oh, well, that's the clamp. Yeah, that's the spiky thing. So he's got the screws in. So you see that spiky thing? That basically clips onto one spinous process above and one spinous process below. And he's got those spikes on it, which literally grip into the bone. And then you'll see him put two clamps on there. So he's going to slide that in. There it goes, into there. That's a 10 millimeter spacer. He's spaced it up before. There are some little spaces you can use. He's got to get his hammer out again, because he needs to get his hammer out, because he's an orthopedic surgeon. And so you'll see that. You'll have a good tap at that. And there's no point doing orthopedic surgery unless you've actually got the sound of hammers and drills going, because otherwise it's useless. Anyway, so there it is in, and he'll take that intrusor off. There the intrusor off. And then what he's going to do is put a couple of great big clamps on and then clamp it together. This is L5S1, which is interesting, because with those clamps on, the spinous process of S1 is not particularly big. Mm. But because you've got nice teeth on it, and even with a small one, you can get quite a good fix on it. And in addition to that, he's fixed. There we are. Here's his hammer again. Needs to get his hammer out. And that's going to tap down into the right place. And then you'll see him with a couple of crimping devices that then get onto that. So what that's doing is he's changing a set screw on there just to fix it. There's a little device there. And here's his crimping device there. He's got one on the top, one on the bottom, and then squeeze as hard as he can. The most important thing there is you don't squeeze it too hard, otherwise you can break the spinous process, and then the whole thing's a disaster. Mm. So that's really it. And then he's going to sew up after that. So I think, Michael, that's probably enough of that video. So that's a minimally invasive spinal fusion. And there are people around in the UK now who can do that. And they often have pictures of a two-pence piece next to your scar. And that will be, because that's the size of the scar that's needed. He's overcooked it a bit, because he's put in some screws at the top, so he's got two incisions. Mm-hmm. So, but I've got good friends who do this sort of thing through a little incision like this, and they use some very sophisticated bits of kit, and they can then fix it completely through that one little two, three centimeter incision. And the important thing about that is that if you've got somebody who has that operation and they're going to hospital that day, they're out the next day. They're not in hospital four, five, 6 days. I mean, we did a lot of work on what's called rapid recovery, and we could change the inpatient stay from 7 days down to 3 days. Now it's down to 1.5 days through these. So there's lots of various ways to make the patient experience better.
And they're back up and walking within a few hours.
They're walking within a couple of hours, and then they're ready for home the next day. Yeah. And because these are so much less invasive, because they don't do so much damage to the muscles, and there's the muscle damage that causes the post-operative pain and the spasm, because they don't do very much damage to the muscle, as a result of which they're back functioning. I mean, that person there, if they've got an office job, should be able to get back to the office job when the soft tissues have healed. 4-5 weeks?
Yeah.
Easy. No problem at all. If they've got a manual job, I think you have to be a bit more cautious, and that's 3 months. And the rehab is essentially designed to be functional. And that is to say, okay, we need to get you back to be able to do your office job as a day job, and then 3 months' time, you can go off and play golf, whatever it is. You can cycle at 4 or 5 weeks. That's absolutely fine, because you don't put any pressure through your back. But you can play golf at 3 months, and you can go and do skiing at 6 months, and that sort of stuff is absolutely fine.
Nick, we've been going for 91 minutes. Are you happy to talk for a little longer?
Yeah, fine.
I hope the audience is as fascinated with this as I am. And we make a great point of not straying beyond our allotted time for these broadcasts. But I think on this occasion, I'm going to make an exception. I'm just trying to rattle through a few of the questions that have come in.
Yes, let's do it.
The first is a case history here. A person, one of our viewers, has a patient who's had a piece of bone removed from a lumbar vertebra rather than a discectomy due to the state of his discs. Is the outcome similar to a discectomy, or are there other potential complications?
No, I mean, that sounds like a bony stenosis, and effectively you've got two mechanisms to get compression of the nerve, one of which is a soft disc that comes out, and that's the discectomy that you saw. Alternatively, in the older population, generally, you get overgrowth of bone, so the facet joints become bulky, and then you get osteophytes on the margin of the disc, the vertebral rim, and so those you're doing much more of a bony decompression than you are a discectomy. So it sounds like a straightforward decompression.
Okay. What's your treatment approach to a degenerative disc with an osteophytic bar encroaching on the nerve root?
Well, that's going to be a decompression. The long and short of it is that if you've got an osteophyte coming from the disc pushing backwards, and if you've then if the disc pushes backwards, be it a soft disc or a hard disc, which is what the osteophytic bars are, we call a hard disc, it meets the back of the spinal canal, which is the facet joint. If the facet joint is bulky, and the poor old nerve is between the two, you've got to make some room. The nerve will quite happily get around that osteophytic bar as long as it's free and got no tension on it. So effectively take the pressure off the back, so you decompress by doing a partial resection of the facet joint and make sure that nerve's completely free.
Do some flossing.
That's fine. And do some flossing. Yeah. The problem is actually that sometimes you get the nerve gets stuck onto those vertebral osteophytes and you have to free that up. But there are specific tools that you can use that you can resect the osteophytes as well. Now, you just move the nerve to one side. Essentially, you know, you take your hammer and you hit the osteophyte and it impacts it, and that then gives the nerve a free run. So that's again part of a decompression.
Nick, that's been great. I think I've still got questions I could ask, but I think perhaps we should spare you that, because it's sounding a bit like an OSCE, what we would call an OSCE, is an end of training exam isn't it? It's been fascinating, absolutely fascinating stuff. Thank you for the videos, thank you for all that stuff about rehab. We'll put as much of the resources as we can up on the website and the references that Nick has used, but thank you very much
for what we've
done this evening.